This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are WCPO.com, WCPO Insider, government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, and education reporter Bob Driehaus, and Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Later in the show, we'll discuss the news from Kentucky with River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. You can join us this afternoon at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Karen, Bob, and Amanda, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Great to be here.
Karen, I've got to start with this because I always love a good feud. There's a feud that started earlier this week between John Kasich and the Republican National Committee. So I'm wondering, can you fill us in on how this started and what this is over?
Well, this was a Saturday or a Sunday morning talk show appearance with Reince Priebus, the head of the RNC, the Republican National Committee. And he was being quizzed by the moderator, Face the Nation on CBS, John Dickerson, about the election and Trump. And you know, the idea that still you have some people within the Republican Party who are not exactly supportive of Trump and, in fact, have not endorsed him. People like, for instance, John Kasich. And Reince Priebus basically said that those people who have not endorsed Trump should get on board, especially those people who had run for president, who had used the party's resources, who had promised to support the eventual nominee, that they need to come to the table and start supporting him. And the question then comes up, you know, is that a threat to somebody like Kasich who might be considering running again in 2020? And Priebus said it's not a threat. It's real because it's a private
fact.
Party. We can support whoever we want. We're going to look at the process. And so the reaction to that was pretty quick. Kasich strategist John Weaver said in a statement that Kasich wouldn't be, and this references Priebus's Wisconsin roots, he wouldn't be bullied by a Kenosha political operative that is unable to stand up for core principles and beliefs. Pretty tough language there. And Ohio Republican Party Chair Matt Borges, who's been rumored to be a possible successor to Priebus eventually, he tweeted out that, quote, this is not what we are all about as a party. And Borges also referenced that, hey, there's an election coming up in 50 days that maybe we ought to be looking at, not just the election 4 years down the road. So it kind of shows that there's still the split, especially between Kasich and Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz and some other people who ran for president who have not been endorsing Trump, and then the people who are trying to get Trump elected, like Reince Priebus and other people who may or may not be completely on the Trump campaign bandwagon but are saying we need to be there.
Karen, did Reince Priebus actually single out Kasich when he was talking about this, or was he more general?
No. John Dickerson, the moderator, singled out Kasich as an example, and Reince Priebus said, sure, he's one. So he didn't necessarily bring him up, but Kasich was definitely brought up. And, you know, any conversation about this, Kasich has to be brought up in the sense that he was the last man standing, so to speak, even though he came in fourth in terms of electoral delegates. He did not go to the convention. He has spoken out against Trump and has said that he doesn't see a future in which he can vote for Trump. And so these conversations certainly have included Kasich, but like I said, by extension, they also include Jeb Bush, they include Ted Cruz and other people.
Amanda, what do you think of all this?
Well, I think especially this after this past week, things kind of came to a head because John Kasich, he went on CNN, talked again about how very unlikely he was to vote for Donald Trump. And then he did this kind of routine on Friday where he went to the White House to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal that Trump has, you know, very much opposed very publicly, but he did it at the White House, just blocks away from Donald Trump opening his new hotel. So I think he almost last week kind of pushed a new, John Kasich, pushed a little bit of a new pressure point there with Reince Priebus. And so I'm not surprised that he's kind of a little fed up with Kasich's antics on some level, I think.
What do you think a feud like this says about the future of the GOP?
Yeah, I think Kasich at this point kind of is still at a loss that this is his party, right? That this is, I mean, this is where his party has gone. So I think no matter who wins the election, we'll still see this very big split between these kind of more moderate, long-term establishment Republicans and people who backed Trump even after the election for years to come.
I want to add one thing. I wonder how other Republicans feel about this, if it makes them a little bit nervous, such as Rob Portman, who has endorsed Trump but has not been campaigning with him. He's even called him out on a couple of comments, though Democrats have noted he's not called him out on some of the really big things that Trump has said. But the slate does get wiped clean, in a sense, after the election. And if Trump wins, then there's little argument about who might be running in 2020. Could be Trump for re-election. If he loses, then, of course, there's a jockeying for position that starts right away for people who want to run as the Republican nominee in 2020. So I just wonder if other Republicans look at this and get a little bit nervous, even though there's a question about if you support Trump and he loses, does that tag you for the rest of your life? Or are you going to always be pointed at as somebody who supported Trump, the losing candidate, who said all these arguably terrible things?
I think that's why they've been so careful, though, about their comments. I mean, you don't see Rob Portman on stage with Donald Trump when he comes to town. You don't see him making grand statements about, you know, how wonderful he is. He's just kind of given
he's
a tepid.
He's been very low-key, hasn't he?
Yes, yes. So I think that's kind of the fine line that they're walking, is either way, they've kind of made some people happy and upset others, but not to an extreme on either level.
On our weekly TV show, The State of Ohio, which we do here at the State House, I had Matt Borges and David Pepper, the Democratic Party chair, on a week or so ago. And I asked Matt Borges directly, are we going to see Rob Portman campaigning with Donald Trump? Are they going to be on the same stage? And he said he couldn't answer that question. I guess that was more of a Rob Portman question. But I think it's a legitimate question. If indeed you do support your party's nominee, are you going to campaign with them? And if not, why not?
And we do see that from the other side, too. When Hillary Clinton comes to town, you know, there are a state and local party leaders that are lining up to get on stage with her and to be there and support her.
One thing that I'm struck by is that despite John Kasich's aggressive opposition to Trump, that Trump is surging in Ohio. it's such an odd election to see voters disregarding the guy they overwhelmingly supported in the primary in Ohio, who says, I just can't get behind Trump. And the voters said, we don't care. We're voting for him anyway.
Well, that's interesting, too, because, Karen, a lot of the conventional wisdom said that Governor Kasich has such a good political machine, such a good organization in the state of Ohio, that his feud with Trump, his disliking of Trump, was going to hurt Trump's chances in the state of Ohio.
Right. And so far, right now, polls are showing that Trump is leading. But, you know, we're still 50 days away. Arguably, the race is not over. But I think this whole idea of people who were never Trump, people who were very concerned about Trump, who have now come onto the Trump campaign and or at least have stopped their opposition, their vocal opposition to Trump, I think they're in a unique position here. I think about the situation happening in Mahoning County, where you've seen this video, perhaps, of the Mahoning County volunteer chair for Trump talking about just making some outrageously incredible comments about how there never was racism until President Obama was elected and all sorts of other things. And she resigned. She was replaced by the Ohio Republican Party's chair or treasurer, Tracy Winbush, who's an African-American from Youngstown, who was also very opposed to Trump. And I mean, even going back to the Republican spring meeting, going back to right before the convention, she was very concerned about Trump. Now she is organizing for him in her home county, and it's really a unique position that some of these folks are being asked to be in, putting themselves in, being put in.
We had something very interesting happen in Cincinnati, Karen. The Inquirer, which has not endorsed a Democratic presidential candidate since, I believe, 1916, Woodrow Wilson.
Oh, my.
Actually is coming out on it online today and over the weekend and endorsing Hillary Clinton.
Right. I'm interested to see how other papers will do and other entities will do. But, you know, this has not been a year where endorsements have mattered at all.
Yeah.
Because
nothing seems to have mattered.
John Kasich would have won.
Exactly. John Kasich would be the nominee. I mean, Amanda's exactly right. So I think it's interesting to note these things. But for a lot of people, endorsements don't matter. In fact, they could even work against some of these candidates because some people are so frustrated with the system, they see endorsements as validation of what they don't want to see in government anymore. And it's really extraordinary.
And You've covered John Kasich for a long time, Karen.
Not lately. He hasn't been around.
Not lately. He hasn't been around. But, I mean, over the years.
Yes.
And how much of this do you think is Kasich's feud and the positioning he's taking? How much of this is him positioning himself for 2020?
A lot. I think he's been interested. I think what, you know, again, he came in fourth in delegates. He was the second, the last person who left the race, the second to last person who left the race, if you count Trump. So I think he's really wanted to be the next in line. He's really wanted to do this. And I think he wants to change the party a little bit, too. I mean, he's talked about making the party more sympathetic to certain causes, to people who live in the shadows and some of these other things that we hear about, that he wants to really put his personal brand of conservatism on the Republican Party. So even if he doesn't run again, I think he certainly wants to be seen as a major figure, heard as a strong voice in the party. And so, you know, being brought up by others who, when he wasn't even on Face the Nation, but to be brought up like this, I think kind of strengthens his argument that he's in the conversation, that he wants to be there, that he wants to be a part of it and wants to be a key player.
Well, and I think he also learned kind of a tough lesson, too, on the campaign trail this year. He didn't have a national network, a strong national network, really, at his disposal. He had a great state network, but now we're seeing he's going and campaigning for senators across the country. And I think that's a really big sign as to, like Karen was saying, that he wants a future somehow, in some way in this party, because he's making sure to make up for that now and build that network for the future now.
But you think Kasich stands his ground on this in the meantime?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I don't think there's any question. I mean, every interview he's asked, are you going to support Donald Trump? And his answers are getting almost to the edge of absolutely not, but they're getting close. You know, I don't see myself voting for Trump. I don't think I can support him. You know, he's definitely pushing that envelope there. And I think it's you know, he's pretty clear on how he feels about Trump, and not just Donald Trump personally, but kind of what he represents. And I think that's what Kasich really has a problem with.
Yes, the people that have been supportive of his decision to stand his ground do so because of his values. They say that they like that he's standing by his values and what he thinks a president should look like. And so it would almost be silly for him to retreat at this point, because it would erase all of that goodwill that he's created between voters that feel that way.
We will continue our review of local news of the week. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is WVXU and WMUB's Fall Fund Drive, and if you've never given before, take that first step right now. Individual contributions from listeners like you help to keep the news and information you depend on every day on the air. You can give online, wvxu.org or wmub.org, or the phone number that Ken gave out, 513-419-7155. This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are WCPO.com, WCPO Insider, government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, and education reporter Bob Driehaus, and Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Bob, we recently had the state school report cards come out. So what did those show?
Well, there are a little over 600 school districts in the state, nearly every one of them, single digits. With the exception of single digits, everybody went down this year. And so there are a lot of unhappy superintendents and a lot of concerned parents.
Yeah. So it's, 600 school districts went down out of, 608?
Yeah.
Okay. What caused this drop? What are they pointing to?
So Ohio gave a different test for the third year in a row. They keep changing the test.
They call it the standard test, but they keep changing it.
That's right. It's sort of a one-off test at this point. This year they changed some rules with how they calculated grades. For example, if you had 98% of your kids passing the third grade reading test, they weren't evaluating you on that. They were evaluating you on how many of the 2% you brought up to on track. And if you didn't bring a lot of that small percentage up, you could have even gotten an F with having almost all your kids reading at grade level.
So how did CPS do? How did the Cincinnati schools do on that?
They didn't do great. They got all D's and F's.
Oh, wow. What did Mary Ronan have to say about this?
Well, she held a press conference to take on the issue head on, and her argument was that the test doesn't really represent all the progress that her kids have made. For example, she said the high school graduation rate rose to 73% from 63% in just 4 years, which is a pretty impressive gain. Yet, because it was at 73%, they still got an F in that category of the report card. And there's nothing built into the report card to give credit for great progress like that. And the other part that she and superintendents throughout the tri-state were arguing about is that there's just no consistency for the teachers and the students when you keep changing the test year to year.
And that's exactly what I've heard in our reporting on the report cards and the reaction to that from traditional public schools, from charter schools, from state leaders, from teachers, from everybody, is that when you change things every single year, instead of having some sort of a 12-year guideline that you can follow and a standard that you can look at, then how in the world can you expect there to be great progress, for there to be big changes? I mean, we were warned that these report cards were going to be bad, that these were, and they're bad. I mean, there are a lot of schools that are very, very disappointed in how far they fell.
Yeah.
But that whole idea of the inconsistency and the lack of one single solid standard that you can hold to for the kids who are in school now, the kids who are starting school, by the time they get to their senior year, what progress will they have made? That's a key issue.
What does this mean to the school districts, though, if their report card is bad? Do they lose funding? Do they undergo review of some kind because of this?
They're being held harmless this year, and actually they don't get a letter grade until 2018. But really, if you're trying to pass a levy in a district and you're trying to show that you're doing the right thing for your kids and everything, and you went from an A to an F or a B to an F or whatever, that really hurts as you're trying to pass levies. And so that's a really hard thing for some of these districts to deal with. And, you know, when you start even looking at the percentages of how far some of these districts fell, I mean, we've got some here in Central Ohio that were up in the 90s and fell down into the 40s and 50s. And that's a huge drop. That's as big a drop as a drop that Columbus City Schools would have taken, where they went from like 13% of indicators met to 6%, you know. So an F is an F. Is it an F? I don't know.
And Bob, CPS has a 7.93 mil levy
right
on November's ballot. So you do have to wonder about what kind of impact that could have.
Yeah. As we were saying before the show, I was on a CPO debate between Coast, which is a local organization that opposes the levy, and a school board member was on it speaking for it. And the Coast executive director had a easy talking points to say, look, this levy, this state report card shows that Cincinnati Public is not making progress, and so let's not throw good money after bad. And the school board member, Eve Bolton, had to give a more nuanced argument about, well, actually, we're making progress here and there. But it definitely becomes a talking point for opponents.
And couldn't you make the opposite argument, too, that shows the necessity of the district having more resources?
Yeah, and they certainly are. CPS points to keeping class sizes at a reasonable ratio, teacher-to-student ratio, as well as their big push into early childhood education, where they're saying, look, K-12 is going to benefit from having kids ready for kindergarten.
Now, the headline on WCPO.com was talking about three different standard tests in 3 years. Mm-hmm. Is the headline next year going to say four different standard tests in 4 years?
As the Three Rivers superintendent told me, they may have found their North Star. They're going to give the same test for the second year in a row this year.
Karen, are any signs in the Ohio legislature that they're looking at this issue, that they're thinking about how do we deal with this? How do provide some stability?
Well, when you've got an issue like you've got, you know, what did we have? I think 60% of schools received a D or an F grade for achievement. Less than 15% received an A or a B grade. That tends to get people calling lawmakers, you know, and especially when you're trying to pass levies, as we were just saying. And so certainly lawmakers are out right now. The Senate's coming back next week to take some action on a bill on infant mortality. But for the most part, lawmakers aren't coming back until after the election. They've got a lot to deal with when they come back. I mean, things like charter schools and the energy standards freeze and some other issues that are going on. But obviously, this idea of what do we do with schools that have with these report cards. I mean, the state school superintendent has been saying we raised the standards, and so these grades were not unexpected. Give them time, let them sit, and let everybody get a chance to adjust to the new standards, because now we're not teaching to an eighth grade graduation educational standard. We want them to be at the 12th grade level when they graduate. You know, the idea of getting kids there is a challenge. And, you know, the state did get rid of the PARC tests, which were controversial, these standardized tests that a lot of people had problems with. They replaced them with a new test. So we got that coming up. So, you know, obviously this is top of mind for a lot of lawmakers, though.
And Karen, you've been following what they do in the State House a lot longer than I have. But what I notice is parties change, ideas come and go, and so there's always a temptation to change the standards to something that they really like. But just the change itself can be really disruptive. And so you've got people like Mary Ronan at CPS. She, at that press conference, she said, please just keep things consistent. And then she said, but we don't like the way we're being evaluated, you know, and that's just the constant struggle of, okay, maybe you have a better idea, but just by instituting that idea, you're going to cause more disruption and less apples to apples comparison for the next year to come, at least.
Right. And even the state auditor, Dave Yost, who he made some widely reported comments about the Department of Education being the worst run state agency. He had also said earlier in the year that as long as the bar keeps moving, it's really hard for schools and communities to try to figure out what's exactly being taught and how kids are learning and how the schools are actually doing. And, you know, the question becomes, especially in some of these schools where the grade went from an A to an F, is this school really an F? Is this school district really an F? And,
right.
And you know, do people really feel about it that way? But that letter grade, that's an example of a standard that did change, because for a long time we were hearing about schools being graded as academic excellence and all these kind of terms that
continual improvement, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Terms that were hard to define. Everybody knows what an A is. Everybody knows what an F is. And so when we changed to the letter grade format, I think that disrupted things a little bit, even though it seems like it's no big deal to change from a term to a letter grade. It does change.
Yeah.
And so the idea of consistency is a big, big deal when it comes to education and how you really measure how kids are doing, especially in the populations that you're measuring. I mean, if you go on the state report card website, look at all the data they put in there. There's a ton of data in there about kids, about income, about teachers, about all sorts of things. It's just a treasure trove of information.
Well, it's a 32-page report card. And, you know, if my son brought home a 32-page report.
That's just the owner's manual?
Yeah, right. I mean, that it's not easy to glean exactly how they're doing.
I'd like to move on to WCPO's debate that they hosted with the Hamilton County Commission candidates.
Yes.
Who was involved in that debate?
Yes, it was the first debate of the season for these commission candidates. We had on the Democratic side, Commissioner Todd Portune, State Rep Denise Driehaus, and then for the Republican side, Anderson Township Trustee Andrew Pappas and current Hamilton County Commissioner Dennis Dieters.
So what were the key issues that were focused on during the debate?
So definitely heroin was one of the biggest issues. I mean, we had this recent string of overdoses, and for the most competitive of the races, Denise Driehaus's race against Dennis Dieters. And really, both of those candidates have kind of a history of working on these issues with heroin. Denise Driehaus has instituted a Good Samaritan law, which allows people to drop off or call about someone who might be overdosing and not face any punishment themselves. And on the other side, Dennis Dieters, as a Coleraine Township trustee, has really pushed this heroin task force that was created under his watch. And what they do is they work with paramedics, police officers to help addicts and follow up with them after they've overdosed and come in contact with them. So they both kind of have some good ideas. So that was a big issue there.
How about MSD? Did that come up?
Of course that came up. Yes. It's interesting. I don't know that there's a huge distinction between the candidates on that one, and I might get in trouble for saying that, but they all kind of just everyone wants to work better with the city, right? I mean, that's the end goal. They want the mess to
right, because I always get confused. The city operates the Metropolitan Sewer District, but the county actually owns the infrastructure.
Yes, and then
is that right?
Some city leaders even say that we own it too. So it's this big mess. And I think the biggest distinction to see there is that the Democrats argue that they would work better with the city because the city is run by Democrats. The Republicans argue, hey, you're going to get the same mismanagement if you hand this over to Democrats for all Democrats to run. So that's kind of the big distinction I would take away from the sewer system there.
And of course, Todd Fortune, being the lone Democrat of the three commissioners, I'm sure he would like to see a fellow Democrat come on board so the Democrats could take control
Absolutely.
Of the county commission. Did he bring that up during the debate? Did he talk about that?
That did come up. One of the things there were two issues that really came up on that vein. The first was children's services. They have a levy on the ballot. It will be for two decades, they have not seen a levy increase, and yet they're dealing with more children. So that was one of the questions that we asked, if it was the right call for the commissioners to approve for yet another year a 0% increase. Dennis Dieters, he maintained that it was absolutely the right call. They don't know how much money they'll have with the budget. And Todd really said that is something that's important to him, raising this budget, and he's been unable to do so because it's been a Republican-led commission, and that these kids need more help, more money needs to be invested in that. So that was one of the topics that came up that he said, hey, if I had another Democrat working with me, this would be changed. Another one, too, was economic development. That was a really big distinction between the Republicans and the Democrats there. The Democrats feel like the county should be investing more in neighborhoods, whereas the Republicans said, hey, this isn't necessarily our job. Let's leave this to the cities and the neighborhoods. They know what's best. So that was another big distinction between the two there.
So, and talking about the heroin crisis, how much is this starting to become, what's the term I'm looking for?
It's, politicized? We know
politicized. Thank you. How much is that starting to become politicized?
We're definitely starting to see that on the county level. You know, really, actually starting with the Rob Portman race, we started to see that this became a big political issue. That was among the first ads that he released, was talking about his work with heroin. And then we're starting to see that trickle down again on a county level where the Republican candidate against Sheriff Jim Neal, who's a Democrat, Gary Lee, has been accusing Sheriff Neal of really playing politics with the heroin crisis because of the billboards you'll see around town with his, it has him standing, picture of him standing, asking people to call this heroin hotline. Neal says, hey, I've been running these ads for a really long time. It's not a political, advertisement of sorts. It's not about me. So we're seeing that. We're seeing, I talked to Dennis Dieters about this last week. He said that even who is on stage at the press conferences can get politicized. So I think it's definitely becoming a political issue.
Okay. And let's see, we're about 47 days away from Election Day, I think, or somewhere in that neighborhood. So it'll all be over soon.
Yeah. And then there's a mayor's race. That
oh, that's right. And then a mayor and city council come after that. Karen, Bob and Amanda, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Great
thanks.
To be here.
WCPO.com, WCPO Insider, government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, and education reporter Bob Driehaus, and Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kastler. Coming up, we'll review the news of the week from Kentucky. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You'll hear something interesting anytime you tune to 91.7 or 88.5. If you haven't made a contribution to help support the station this year, if you have made a contribution, I should say, we'd like to say thank you very much. If you haven't had a chance to make a contribution, we'd love to hear from you right now. Make that phone call to 513-419-7155, or you can give online, wvxu.org or wmub.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me now as we continue our review of the news, this time with the focus on Kentucky, River City News Editor and Publisher Michael Monks, and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ryland and Michael, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Thanks, Mark.
Michael, interesting development. I believe it was yesterday the Kentucky Supreme Court ruled that Governor Matt Bevin overstepped his authority by cutting state universities' budgets by 2%. What does this decision mean exactly? What's this going to do?
So it looks like that the unilateral decision that the governor made back in the spring that there was going to be a 2% cut to the public institutions of higher education in the state violated the law, and the Supreme Court told him so. So there was some celebratory news releases from Attorney General Andy Beshear, who challenged this in the state's highest court, which ruled against the governor, and continues that fresh and soon-to-be long-running feud between the Bevins and the Beshears. So I guess it means at this point that the universities can expect to adjust their budgets a little bit.
Ryland, this was, what was it, $18 million that this the 2% represented?
Yeah, it's $18 million. So they agreed to set the $18 million aside before while the lawsuits were ongoing. And so that gets divvied up between all the state colleges and universities, community colleges as well. So it doesn't wind up being, you know, a huge amount of money in the grand scheme of these university budgets, but certainly considering they're heading into 2 years of reduced appropriations as well, it'll plug a few holes. The Attorney General recommended that they go towards, you know, possibly some sort of tuition waiver program or something to somehow ease the cuts on students.
So you were saying, Michael, that you got some celebratory press releases from Andy Beshear because he had challenged this in court. So he obviously is pleased with the decision. What about from Bevin's side of things? What's their reaction?
Well, they weren't happy. He says he strongly disagrees with the decision that came down from the court. And I think both sides have accused each other of politicizing some of these issues. And that's really the fascinating thing to watch from a political standpoint, as important as the higher education budgets are. It probably means about $1 million, by the way, for NKU, that 2%. It was just under $1 million for Northern. They didn't have a whole lot to say about it. When I reached out to them yesterday, they said that they were still evaluating what it meant. And you may recall that Northern announced that they were eliminating some positions in the 2017-2018 fiscal budget, and I was told that this change does not affect that decision at all. So the impact is relatively minimal, but it does have higher stakes for, again, the Beshear and Bevin feud that continues in Frankfurt today.
Ryland, what was the basis for making the 2% cut in the first place?
The governor wants to put it towards the pension systems, which we a recent report showed that the pension systems are officially the worst funded in the nation as a whole. It was part of a grander scheme of across the board cuts. Kind of what was special about this is that these cuts happened to a budget that had already passed. So this is to the budget that was passed, in 2014 by the legislature. And he went ahead and said, you know, okay, we're going to reduce, you know, this last bit by 2%, which, you know, equated that $18 million.
Ryland, was that the main argument, that it was a current budget and that's why he exceeded his authority?
Yeah, that was the main argument against him. Also, the Attorney General was, he was arguing that it was a separation of powers issues. And interestingly enough, the Supreme Court didn't really take up that part of the argument. They just said, you know, legally that the governor couldn't do this, that it wasn't so much a constitutional issue as much as, you know, okay, because of how, disbursements to the universities work, that, you know, the universities end up signing these checks. It's not the state treasurer or anything, so that they couldn't really adjust that number.
On the topic of Kentucky's pension funds, just how bad off are those, Ryland?
They're pretty bad. The main pension fund for state employees is about 17% funded, has about 17% of the money it needs to make future payouts to retirees. This is the teacher pension fund, which is a lot bigger because teachers get larger pensions, but it requires a lot more money from the state because of that. It's doing a little bit better at about 45% funded, but really this is the result of years of underfunding by the legislature. I think it's something like 15 of the last 22 years the state has not made has not put an adequate contribution into the pension systems to keep them from losing money. And so going forward, because of that, it's going to require a really long time to try and shore these pension systems back up, or to nurse them back into health. And it's going to require years and years of making appropriations into the pension systems that are probably a little bit larger than usual. There's also been talk of setting up a dedicated revenue source for the pension systems, which that's kind of a perennial call, just so, there's a reliable amount of money heading into them. But, we'll see what happens going forward.
I think the calls recently have been for legislative remedies that lead to more transparency in mm-hmm. the pension funds.
Yeah, there's been a lot of criticism lately of the investment strategies of the pension systems. One big critique is their use of hedge funds, and the deal with hedge funds is that investment managers who manage these funds they get paid a whole lot of money for this, and that money comes out of the pension funds themselves. And so one of the proposals is to, one, make the contracts with those managers open so that at least, lawmakers would be able to see it. Some people want those to be totally public so people in the public can see them. Investors will say, and pension officials will say, that you can't make them totally open because it's kind of revealing the secret sauce of these contracts. And then, other people looking for invest will be able to undercut those contracts. Then there's also talk of changing the way these the boards of these pension systems are managed. One proposal recently by a Democratic lawmaker was to forbid any future reorganizations of the pension system by the governor. And that's kind of a
isn't that open. Something he actually tried to do recently?
Yeah, it's a pretty open critique. Okay. The governor recently overhauled the pension system, and that move is currently being challenged in court. So there's a lot of these transparency requests, and it's become an increasingly political issue, especially this year, since there are 65 contested races for state House seats, and Republicans are trying to take control of the House. Republicans really champion, they say that they're the champions of transparency. They had a bill last session that came out of the Senate that they really wanted to pass on pension transparency. They say that Democrats blocked that. And now this summer, after the legislative session and in the heat of these legislative battles, Democrats have lo and behold come up with pension transparency bill. It's not as clear cut as that description of it. There were some Democrats who were in favor of that bill during the legislative session, but something happened in which that bill was not allowed to be passed out of the legislature.
And that's interesting who you brought up, the presence of the GOP. That's been Mitch McConnell's big push. He's wanted to see more GOP lawmakers in Kentucky.
Certainly. That's kind of the last bastion of Democrats legislatively in Kentucky. The phrase that we use over and over again is that Kentucky has the last democratically controlled legislative chamber in the South. Democrats have been in control of the House since 1922, and so Republicans they're close. They've got 47 of the 100 seats. Democrats have 53 in the House, and if Republicans were able to take control, then they would have control of the legislative process. They'd have the Senate, which has a wide margin of Republicans. The House, and of course Republican Governor Matt Bevin, to sign kind of some of these big ticket Republican pieces of legislation.
Rand Paul was in Newport for a town hall this morning. Did either of you hear anything from that, from what happened there?
Not yet. I think that I saw a headline come across one of the publications up here about maybe he appeared on one of the networks and was talking about how ill he thinks Hillary Clinton is. But outside of that, I haven't heard a great deal about that. But obviously, he's got a reelection campaign to wage for his second term that he'd like to have in the United States Senate. And he's up against Democrat Jim Gray, the mayor of Lexington. And I haven't heard a whole lot about what he might have said in Newport this morning, but he's probably going to carry the three counties up here pretty successfully. He did last time.
Okay. Now, moving on to another topic, the IRS. Recently, Covington got an announcement from the IRS that it's going to be cutting jobs in Covington at the Flat Top facility, I think it's called, Michael?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is located on West 4th Street?
Correct.
Okay. How many employees are going to be affected by this?
So they're talking about approximately 1,800 total, 1,600 there in Covington, the remainder coming from a facility out in Florence. Just shell-shocking news to come out of nowhere, really. Everyone caught off guard by this announcement. And
out of 1,800, out of how many?
There's about 4,000 total IRS employees.
Wow, so it's close to half.
Yeah, it is close to half. The remainder of those employees work in what is known as the Gateway Building. It's a large gray building that takes up a whole city block in downtown Covington, right across the street from the Flat Top facility. But these are employees who commute to town and support a lot of the surrounding businesses. Obviously, a huge chunk of Covington's payroll tax. I heard one figure that stated that this was about 10% of the jobs in the whole city. And for the announcement to come out of nowhere, no one knew. Mitch McConnell didn't know. The city didn't know. We got a message from Matt Bevin's office that the state didn't know. Nobody knew this was coming. And so now, if there's any silver lining, it's that this doesn't fully take effect for about 3 years. So the city and its counterparts in the federal government have the opportunity to expedite the transfer of the property, to seek opportunities for redevelopment, and also to try to find some comparable jobs that might be able to locate within the city. But that's going to be a big deal. It's already entered the narrative in the mayor's race. Covington has a mayor's race coming up. And so who's going to be best suited to navigate these scary waters that the city's entering with 1,600 jobs on the horizon to depart, completely disrupting this very positive narrative that was emerging downtown. They've got about 500 to 700 new jobs that are coming to the River Center Towers with a life sciences company that's relocating there from Blue Ash called CTI. They've got 115 new jobs moving from Crestview Hills to the Huntington Bank building downtown. So all this good stuff, all these new apartments that are coming, new businesses that are opening, and really nice white-collar jobs that were coming to town. That was the narrative for several weeks. And then out of nowhere, this thing that has been a base of Covington's economy for 30 years is going to be gone.
Well, did the IRS give an indication of why they're doing this?
So obviously all of us are filing online, and there's just not as much to process. So they are closing multiple facilities. They didn't just point at Covington and remove it. So they are closing some facilities across the country. In fact, they're only leaving two similar ones, one in Kansas City and one in Utah. Now, I heard something interesting, and Covington has long sought to redevelop this site. Those of you who can picture the IRS building, the Flat Top facility.
It's called the Flat Top. It's long,
yeah, it's
wide,
one
it has
story,
a flat roof.
Huge, yeah, absolutely. Takes up a large swath of land on otherwise valuable real estate right there by the river. And the city has for a long time wanted to develop it for the purposes of maybe incorporating it into the riverfront plans or to expand the convention center. And so they're going to get their chance, maybe not the way they wanted, but what they had hoped was that we could move the IRS into a vertical building. And so what I'm hearing is that there were some prioritized sites where such moves were going to take place, and Covington was third on the list. The federal government was heavily considering moving its employees to stay in Covington but into a vertical building, and they didn't make the cut by one slot. So the whole thing could have been completely different narrative and really a life-saving narrative, and now Covington's going to have to do a lot of adjustment.
So the employees who are being cut, are they going to get any kind of assistance?
Well, again, these are people who have a few years to plan their lives.
To make an adjustment.
That's right. And I've talked to a lot of them. They're, you know, a lot of them can't speak openly on the record, but the messages that I'm getting is they were all caught off guard too. The union representing these employees didn't know. They were all caught off guard as well. And there had been complaints in recent months about the conditions of the building anyway. So there may have been some signs that there was a change coming. But as for what type of transition opportunities will be available, that's not yet clear.
Ryland, medical marijuana has been a topic in Kentucky recently. The Kentucky Nurses Association endorsed a bill that would regulate marijuana, saying that providing legal access to medical cannabis is imperative. Is Kentucky going to be following Ohio and legalizing medical marijuana anytime soon?
It's at least from listening to lawmakers talk about it, it doesn't seem to be the case. That also, again, since this is an election year and it is somewhat of a controversial topic, doesn't seem like lawmakers are particularly eager to put their necks out there for this issue. But yeah, this summer has been somewhat historic in that lawmakers have been having hearings like during the legislative interim, just kind of having people discuss the pros and cons of legalizing medical marijuana. This week, there was a committee hearing in which a cancer doctor from Louisville, you know, just basically gave some anecdotal evidence of how he believes that the drug really helps his patients. You know, he doesn't prescribe it to them, but they go out and find it themselves, and he just kind of says, you know, they seem a lot happier. And lawmakers are pretty skeptical or not convinced by that testimony. They kind of want more evidence. Their concerns are, you know, the chemical makeup of it. They say that there's so many chemicals that go into the plant, and it's too complicated, and there's not enough research to show that it's all safe. And then also just the effects of it. They're not, you know, totally convinced that it's beneficial, and they're worried that it would be diverted into the general population, that you know, people who had been prescribed it for medical reasons would, you know, give it to their friends, or other people who weren't prescribed it would be able to get hold of it.
And you think to some extent Kentucky's watching Ohio to see how things go here?
I definitely think Kentucky is watching other states. That's kind of the and certainly they're watching Ohio. It's just kind of seeing how the regulatory framework in other places is playing out before. They're kind of waiting to see which way the cat's going to jump.
Ryland and Michael, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier with help from Kevin Reynolds. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. In 1978, Elizabeth Andes was found dead in her Oxford apartment by her boyfriend, who was charged but found not guilty of killing her. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll talk with Inquirer journalists investigating the cold case. We'll also hear about treehouses for adults, and in Focus on Technology, a state-of-the-art kitchen to train new doctors about the role diet plays in staying healthy. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.